Outer Wilds, a unique sci-fi adventure released in 2019, has been a huge hit with critics and players alike. In our modern age of AAA juggernauts, DLC maps and loot boxes, games with a little more inspiration and imagination are harder to unearth. But Alex Beecham and the rest of the team were clearly onto something in 2015 when an unfinished alpha won the Seamus McNally Grand Prize. Then, many of Outer Wilds' central ideas were yet to develop, but the general atmosphere was more than enough to help the title complete its 7-year development. As you play, action concentrates on the open exploration of a compressed solar system, allowing you access to your very own rickety spaceship and providing a host of different worlds to visit. Despite those sci-fi leanings, there's a warm and humble feeling throughout, echoing a founding premise of camping in space. Scored by Andrew Pralo, a lot of the soundtrack is built on banjos, guitars, and other fireside classics, like Simple Whistling, to reflect that. However, the music also makes clever use of soundscapes, synths, and textures, all contributing to a decidedly post-rock sound that perfectly captures the setting. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. After Outer Wilds' incredible haul of Game of the Year wins at the end of 2019, it's a huge pleasure to welcome Andrew Pralo onto the show. Having worked on audio for the release from the beginning of its development, Andrew's soundtrack is as refined as it is beautiful. But before we kick into some of the details behind its creation, it's only fair that I warn you of the multiple story spoilers throughout this episode. One of Outer Wilds' greatest strengths is its mystery, and I'm keen to maintain the power of that narrative for those who haven't yet completed it, or are interested in starting. So, to go right back to the beginning, how did this fascinating project begin? And what were the earliest inspirations behind its music?
Well, Alex had another... He had some sort of other thesis that we worked on together called Tales from the Minus Lab, and he was a big part of that. And then afterwards, like, he had to get his next one together. So for his grad thesis, it was Outer Wilds. So we kind of just had some of the same people that were on Minus Lab, like, switch over to Outer Wilds. And then it kind of went from there and, like, turned into this whole huge thing that ended up lasting for, like, 7 years around. So the first thing that we thought of when Alex mentioned the idea to me, I thought of the banjo, and that kind of crafted the whole score. Like, the very first idea I came up with was this one that we ended up using for, like, the pre-alpha trailer called Campfire Song, so it was just, like, a little bit too much rock sounding. And then the second piece I ever wrote was, like, the what you hear on the main title of the game. And then from there, like, that kind of crafted the whole score, just that one simple banjo melody. That's how we started, and we didn't know where it would go from there, but initially his idea to me was, he said, hey, I'm going to make a game about camping in space. You're going to be able to roast marshmallows in it, and it's going to feel just kind of calm, but also very scary in the sense that you don't have too much technology, like the alien race that you are. It's kind of like shoddily put together, so it'll make it like kind of terrifying in its own way. And it was exciting to be able to write this these campfire songs, and then write kind of more out there sci-fi textures and music and stuff as we went along. But I'd say that stuff didn't develop until we kind of put together the backstory to the Nomai.
The Nomai are a key race in Outer Wilds, with their intentions and backstory forming some of the game's biggest mysteries. Interacting with their technology, or learning more about their history, tends to come with unique sound design and music. But in order to leave certain spoilers about their nature till later in this podcast, let's concentrate on that founding inspiration of camping in space. That sound, and feeling, is much clearer from the outset, which sees you awakened by the crackle of a campfire. On our own planet, the humble banjo is closely associated with trips to the great outdoors and roasting marshmallows. So what makes it work just as well in a completely different solar system?
I had a banjo that was given to me by one of my best friends named Chris, and I brought it to LA with me when I originally moved here, and I never knew what I was going to do with it. And it was an old beat-up banjo, and when Alex mentioned camping in space, the first thing I thought of was acoustic guitar, but I thought that's a little too on the nose. So I was like, oh, I have this banjo that I haven't used on anything. My thought of having this alien sitting there playing a banjo in space just seemed really cool to me. I just thought it would be fun, and I was like, just with that idea, that's when I was like, this could be really cool, because I can take that and easily with that idea. No one, not to my knowledge, has anyone used banjo in a sci-fi score before, so I could just run with it and take it as far as I could. And that's the reason why I thought of it. I was like, this seems really creative and fun to do. And I was like, it'll be fun to play banjo and manipulate it and throw it through all these effects and stuff and kind of turn it into this weird space folk sort of sound. I was thinking about how, if he's playing guitar, that's kind of... there's got to be a better way to approach it than just a guitar. So I was trying to think of just something that was similar and just a little bit more out there, maybe a little bit more quirky. But then taking the quirkiness of it and turning it into something pretty serious. And I think Zelda does that in a really fun way where they'll take those I was watching some old Majora's Mask footage yesterday. And just seeing the Zora playing that weird electric guitar thing, it's just so charming and a little bit funny in a way. But if you craft the music correctly, as you get absorbed into the world, you really start to believe that it's real. Suspend disbelief. You kind of just jump into that world, and then all of a sudden, this kind of goofy looking alien guy in a spacesuit playing a banjo becomes serious and nostalgic and sad at the end even. So I was able to touch on so many different emotions just with that instrument, which was really wonderful. I'm not the best banjo player by any means, but it was cool to approach that stuff in a very simple way, in a way that a lot of campfire tunes are written, where it's about something that everyone can learn and about something that can be catchy and get stuck in your head and like something that you want to hum or sing along to.
Outside of textures, soundscapes, and Andrew's heavy use of affected electric guitar, Outer Wilds is summed up by five simple, distinctive sounds, all literally played at different points by characters you encounter. Those travellers, found separately around the game's solar system, are each equipped with their own instruments, except Eska, who dutifully whistles along with their melody. In fact, each isolated player performs just one part of a whole, which forms a full, gorgeous arrangement as they come together in a group. How did Andrew decide what instruments to use for the travellers, and when did their musical connection become a part of the story?
Very, very early on. That was the one thing where I was like, if we're having four instruments, we should have them all. They're part of the same solar system. Let's have them have it so that I think musicians might probably notice that it's in the same key when you kind of zoom around with your signal scope. But I don't know if I tried to make it obvious enough to where you're like, oh, like this could all work together. And then you can like zoom way out of the solar system, and like if you line them all up, they're all playing together like the same song, so it's like this nice little like space ensemble. But yeah, that was one of my initial ideas like way back in the beginning, and I think that really did help craft like the backbone to the score in a very major way. Like, so I came up with the different instruments we could use, and it ended up being like the harmonica, the flute, which I actually like sampled the trumpet mute, and put it in through this program called EXS in Logic, and kind of sampled it like they do in the N64 days, where you kind of just move around the same few notes and create this like sort of fake sounding but like nostalgic flute instrument. And then we had the percussion, which we went through a few revisions, and I brought in Alex to whistle. I can't whistle, so I needed someone to do it. I just thought it would be a really nice moment to have him in the game and as a voice, since there's no VO, so it's really one of the only like human singing sounds in the game besides some textures I did like with my own voice, but I kind of just reverbed it out so far that it's hard to tell mostly that it's a voice.
There's definitely a familiarity in the opening environments of Outer Wilds, supported in Andrew's music and instrumental choices. Timberhearth, where players begin, is a fertile land of green trees and rich soil, much like great swathes of earth itself. But it's also where you encounter your faithful, if somewhat ramshackle, spaceship. After a bit of adjustment, the game will soon have you launching comfortably into the stars, and weaving between the various planets and locations on offer. At that point, drifting in space, the game opens up immensely, leaving you with your own curiosity and a whole solar system to satisfy it.
What I did for that part is all the music in Timberhearth is very sleepy for the most part. And then when it kind of zooms out and you start to see this whole galaxy that you're in and that you can finally explore all these different planets. I wanted the music to feel like relaxing and calm, because if the music was just intense the whole time, I think it would have really ruined the whole vibe of the game, where it's about the joy of exploration and the joy of curiosity. Even though you are doing things that are very intimidating and huge and dangerous, I wanted to feel like you could just hang out in space and love flying around. And even if you crash and you die, like, you're like, oh, like, I can reset and here I go again. And it's just I wanted the music to feel relaxing and also like a little bit joyful.
Outer Wilds is filled with set themes and definitive pieces saved for certain locations or moments. However, one of the soundtrack's most unique features is its willingness to stay quiet when appropriate. Silence can have an amazing effect in video games, usually helping to underline stark or unexpected situations. Though that's the case in Outer Wilds too, it's taken a step further as puzzles and discoveries unfold. The restrained use of music in general makes it all the more conspicuous when it does play, meaning that clues and subtle signposting are inherent features of Andrew's OST. Paying close attention to it as you play can be invaluable to picking up hints and confirming when you're on the right path.
When I was kind of playing early builds of the game, and we had like the kind of the exploration theme in there, we were trying to decide if we were gonna have the music, like what we were gonna do in the planets and with the planets and stuff, and if the music should still be playing when you're out of your ship. But I just loved the idea that if you like accidentally fall through like the black hole, or if your ship gets destroyed and like kind of thrown apart, I loved the idea that all you can do, like, you're just isolated in space and all you can hear is like your own breathing in your spacesuit, and you're kind of just waiting for the loop to end at that point, and you can't do anything. And I felt like it was a lot more scary and more realistic to how large space really is and how desolate and alone you would be until like the final like end of loop music kicks in. I mean, to me, I don't know, I just was really excited about that idea of keeping everything feel very, very isolated in the moments of the game where you should, and to that kind of brings in the fear for those moments. Only using music when something important would be happening, rather than like having it turn into just like looping music the whole time. Like that way people would pay attention and like be like, oh, music is entering, I wonder what this means. And then kind of as you get loop over and over, start to realize that different kinds of music will mean different things, and like something is happening important, or maybe you should be exploring that area, or maybe you're about to find like a very big clue.
When music takes a direct hand in gameplay, like in Outer Wilds, VGM becomes truly its own medium. I first had my mind open to the idea when discussing Portal 2 with Mike Muraski, and I've since come to believe that reactive and communicative music separates game soundtracks from almost all other forms of composition. Most modern titles that don't gesture back to retro mechanics use dynamic systems for their audio, but it's masterfully done in Outer Wilds. The OST becomes more than just gorgeous icing on a cake, simply hanging in the background as extra decoration. It takes a vital role in your journey, though quietly, subliminally, and without interrupting your own epiphanies.
I think the Know My Music really does it best sometimes, where you'll be entering an area and all of a sudden you'll start to hear like a little bit of an ambience in the background, or you'll start to hear like the lone piano I have playing sporadically throughout. So then you know you're kind of getting close to something. Or in once you get to the center of some of the planets, like musical themes will kick in, letting you know that you're like, you finally made it and this is where you're supposed to be, without giving it away. Since a lot, I feel like Alex Kelsey crafted something very beautiful with the way that they don't guide the player at all. And there's no really hand-holding, and it's even like super difficult to just learn how to fly your spaceship without crashing all the time. And so I was able to take these really subtle cues with the score and kind of give like my own little hints to, hey, you're in the right spot, rather than like giving it away. A lot of that was just, I set up a piano system and an ambient system where I have them slowly faded in over like, it's probably like 10 seconds or something, 10 to 15 seconds. And then that way it's kind of like, you're like, oh, I'm here, and there's this ambience playing. And then the piano will kick in every 20 to 30 seconds, I think, but I have it kind of set in this randomized order so that it's just this like free-flowing piece that still is, the Know My theme will come back in, and I have like a couple different versions of that.
Besides an actual musical theme for the Know My, centered on the piano, interacting with Know My technology and uncovering their past comes with heaps of unique sound design. The audio in Outer Wilds is consistently as impressive as the score that surrounds it, and was largely handled by Trevor Johnson. Yet, the Know My was still characterised by Andrew Prahlow, including their sound effects and general aural atmosphere. How did the SFX work for Outer Wilds come to be split between Trevor and Andrew? And what did they each bring to the project?
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting process because it went on for so many years. Like, I started off on the game as audio director, and then I was making all the Know My soundscapes and while working on the music. And eventually, like, I'm really great at creating melodic sound design and crafting atmospheres, but I feel like my like Foley skills and all that is something that I didn't think I was really capturing the mood of Outer Wilds for. So eventually, like, my position turned into working on all the Know My stuff for sound design and writing their music. And then someone else came in and helped with, I think, like, they did a revision on one of the Know My tech sounds, and they did all the sound design for, like, say, like, Brittle Hollow and all that, like, all the crazy, like everyday sound effect type elements. So my sound design portion was mostly everything that sounds really creepy or weird in the game, and textural or otherworldly or has some sort of a melody. That was my approach, and those are the sounds that I love creating. And I mean, it kind of reflects into a lot of the ambient music that I write too. It really is the same approach. It's just leaving it more minimal, maybe, and figuring out ways to implement it into the game. Also, while combining the textures I created for the Know My technology, that they kind of speak with their emotions through the sounds of their technology, and I got to do a lot of cool melodic things with, like, their Skype system and with the way a lot of their puzzles worked.
Along with the depth in Outer Wilds audio, it's always simply satisfying to hear. It convincingly places the player within the game world, immersing you in the experience. And at times, it can be downright unsettling, intentionally so, like when using projection stones. Those kinds of textures use clever tricks to help with that feeling, and there are some surprisingly involving ways to achieve good sound design. So, what's Andrew's process for building his environments, and how do you effectively unsettle a listener?
I think it's working a lot with having things waver in tone. That's what I did a lot with that. And imagining like an old cassette or an old like record playing that's kind of like warped in a sense. So using tones like that is really how I approached that whole Know My Skype sound texture. And it's that combined with maybe keeping some of the tones very flat and cold, and imagining like setting a lot of times like I'll do a lot of pre-production in my own mind. Like there's this lesson that I learned for composing where really it was really interesting, and it's an exploration of your own imagination where, and this is how I write a lot of my music and why I will wait until I kind of fully realize it. Especially with textures, like you imagine yourself like lying down in a bed or something, and then on top of that you imagine yourself like what's around in the room you're in, and then add on like what city are you in, like what's the temperature like, is there like a skylight, like, and then from there it's like what's outside, are there birds outside, are there trees outside, and you kind of collectively add on an element one by one until you imagine this whole scene you're in, and then contextually you take that and just do it with the sounds that you want to create. So, and just it takes a lot of practice, but at a certain point I'm quick enough now where I can kind of think like, oh, I can use this pedal or this sound or this guitar or this synth, and kind of know what to do right away, so that way my workflow, I'm kind of jumping in knowing what I'm creating and what I'm supposed to be creating, and then through that I'll find happy accidents and maybe it'll shift another direction. But I found it makes music a lot more easy to write, especially when working with just ambiences and things that can be really out there.
Imagining a setting completely and all the different elements that could influence its audio is an amazing exercise, but the sounds themselves eventually have to be performed, refined, and arranged. That might include working with a full orchestra, wrestling with synths, or even licensing bands. Electric guitar was often a starting point for Andrew, and usually through heavy processing and pedals. Guitar pedals allow players to change their sound significantly, from reverbs and digital delays to distortions and more. But what suited Outer Wilds and helped define its soundtrack?
I find that it's easier for me to come up with melody and the actual instrumentation by first kind of, like, I'll mess with a lot of loop pedals and just create sounds and drones. And, like, a lot of the Know My sounds, I used, called a Strymon Timeline. And they have, like, a lot of, like, creepy modulation on it. So that was a big influence for the Nomai soundscapes for sure. And I used, like, a lot of, like, Walrus audio gear. They make just a lot, like, so it was a lot of, like, guitar pedals, and I was just running synths and guitars through it, manipulating it to the point that it didn't sound like guitar anymore at all. And then even in the Hearthian stuff, there's a little bit of that I layer in just to make the sound, like, make it sound kind of larger than life while sticking with, like, the four main instruments of the game until the strings come in towards the end. I mean, I'm a big believer in kind of tone stacking in a way where instead of having, like a lot of people have, like, maybe, like, a compressor and then, like, an overdrive into, like, kind of having things in order, like, it's kind of like creating, like, a bunch of mini pedal boards where, like, maybe you have a reverb and then, like, you'll have another reverb at the end or something, and then you add even another color, like, once you record it, and doing the same thing with, like, delay. That's the way I create a lot of these sounds, or it's cool to, like, record it, manipulate it, then send it back through, or figuring out ways to manipulate by, like, if you decide to throw it through an amp or throw it direct in. And I think a lot of it is, like, experimenting and happy mistakes, and, I mean, at that point with the Strymon timeline, I'd had it for so long that I was, like, pretty good at knowing, like, which settings worked the best for me. Like, I just kind of created a couple custom settings with that, as, like, presets that were, like, the Outer Wilds presets, really. Another cool thing I found is, like, if you, like, just, slow stuff down two times, or, like, speed it up by two, or, like, pitch shift it all after the fact, once I put it into the computer, and you can get these, like, artifacts and stuff to make it sound, like, really worn down.
Guitar pedals, by their very nature, affect an instrument's sound directly as it's being played. But you can get similar results by applying post-production to a recording you've already made. Such enhancements are standard most of the time, but live guitar recordings don't necessarily call for much. Although it obviously depends on the sound you're going for, rooms, amps, and pedals can do the lion's share of tone sculpting before mics are even set up. That said, it would be unusual for a game like Outer Wilds to use completely raw recordings. So what kind of post-production would Andrew add to his guitars?
Not as much. I'd say the main post-production things I would do with a lot of these sounds would be like either adding stereo delay or stereo reverb or just like stereoizing it somehow. I mean, a lot of times I'll just track it in mono. I don't really have any reason why I always track in mono, but it's just what I'm used to, and I know like all like my special tricks I do once I put it into the computer, how to make it sound like pretty big but still focused. I'm pretty minimal once I put things in besides like EQ and compression, and like, I mean, it really does, I kind of mix as I go also, and like start even putting it through a mastering chain like maybe halfway through the process, so I kind of just see how things are sitting, because I tend to over record and then start muting things to kind of clean it out. I like to get all my ideas done first, and then that way, like, it's kind of, like, pretty much finished, and once I'm done, like, it's already almost mixed, and I just have to make some tweaks.
It would be fair to say that the vast majority of modern-day game soundtracks fall into two camps: orchestral or retro. Of course, there are exceptions that prove that rule, and Outer Wilds is one of them. In many ways, it's the use of guitar that helps it stick out. But there's more to it than that too. There's a general philosophy and influence behind Andrew's music that separates it from other scores. In particular, a love for post-rock is evident in a lot of key themes, reflecting the genre's swooping, affected guitars and dreamlike arrangements. Post-rock is actually among the first styles I fell in love with as a teen, largely thanks to my brother's extensive collection of Mogwai and Godspeed You Black Emperor albums. When it comes to that style, what bands and artists come to Andrew's mind?
Yeah, definitely Mogwai and Godspeed. And Explosions in the Sky, of course. I really love Sigur Rós and This Will Destroy You. I think last year came out with one of the, like, New Others Part 1 and Part 2, I think is probably one of my favorite post-rock records in a couple years, because they explore a lot of cool textures. And I know a lot of these bands work with that producer John Congleton, and just watching interviews with him and hearing him talk about it and how he likes to approach working with bands, like, I learned a lot about that with the way that I kind of set up my boards and the way I approach sound within the music. Like, of course, I love minimalist ambient composers like Max Richter and Johan Johansson. I think they kind of delve into that post-rock territory. But yeah, it's like a genre I've just loved for quite a long time, and I love how it speaks through the music almost in like a soundtrack sense, and I think that's why a lot of those post-rock bands ended up getting into scoring for film. I mean, No Man's Sky had like 65 Days of Static on their score, and they really crafted that like a record, but that's been a band I've been listening to for a while.
"65 Days of Static's" work on No Man's Sky, which you can hear more about in a previous episode, is one of the few times where post-rock is the prevailing influence in a game. And within, you can hear just about every aspect of the genre in keen focus. One of those is the unmistakable sound of huge, crashing drums, usually following a tense, protracted build-up. Percussion and traditional drums mostly take a back seat in Outer Wilds, which is much more concerned with tone and ambience. That lack of rhythm has a truly otherworldly effect on gameplay, solidifying that we're light years from Earth and the incessant beats of our various cultures. How did Andrew approach his percussion for the release, and why did he decide to keep it restrained?
I didn't really go too out of the way with the percussion, because I wanted it to, stay subtle. I was using a lot of, besides the Traveler percussion, a lot of it was just standard, like, huge-sounding drums, or just, like, kind of ticky-tacky type things to, like, keep a groove going and pushing it forward. And I manipulated it in a way that a lot of composers will do, where they just use, like, a delay on it, or, like, sort of, like, different filters and stuff. And I just crafted it and kind of went with simplicity with the percussion, because you're absolutely correct, there's barely any percussion in the whole game. A lot of it's just super ambient, so I didn't want to overthink it. I just kind of went for what felt right and what still, like, the world of Outer Wilds really is about the ambiences within the music. So I didn't want to just go into this huge, like, percussive thing. Except when you're in the, this is also another spoiler, like, the whole last, like, there's this final cue that's, like, probably like 20 seconds long called Let There Be Light. And with that one, I did use like a huge, I crafted this like huge, massive drum for that. So that's probably the part where I really wanted to just have like this explosion of like a just huge blast of like almost like a cannon going off or something. Or like to really, it simulates like the Big Bang. That lead is like a synth lead combined with I went for like this huge like post-rock guitar sound on that one. So I just found like just a really cool guitar tone that I loved and kind of tracked that for that cue.
Synths twinkle their way in and out of the OST to Outer Wilds, intermingling with guitar textures and Traveller instrumentation. One of the times where they really come to the forefront, though, is in the theme for the Sun Station. Aptly, its sound is remarkably warm, blanketed in pads and resonant swells. It's just a single example of Andrew's knack for layering different tones into a unified whole, too, which is important when crafting the atmosphere of another solar system.
Even though that is only one synth pad, it's really probably like four or five different synths combined with guitar playing the same thing. And I find warmth through the subtle texture to the sound, and the easiest way to create something subtle is by taking elements of a lot of different layers and turning them all into one sound. I did the same thing with the Know My Piano sound. Even though it's one sound, it really is like a whole bunch of different pianos combined with like my upright that I use in my studio, and taking little pieces of each piano and turning it into one sound. Probably one of my favorite things about exploring music now is creating these like huge pads and textures that I don't know, it's just so fun for me to explore that, and there's always ways to get better. And I really admire like other composers like John Hopkins. I think he's like the master of that craft in a lot of ways right now, because I know he came from he's like an IDM background in a lot of ways. So I learned this stuff from just reading interviews with him about how he takes like little elements from a lot of different things to create one huge sound.
In order to actually create sounds and play with different synths, every composer needs a reliable DAW, or digital audio workstation. These are essentially the canvases that musicians and audio professionals use to record and refine their ideas. There are many popular choices available, and most have come up, or will come up, at some point in this podcast, including Cubase, Ableton, Pro Tools, and many more. For Outer Wilds, Andrew used Logic, software I make heavy use of myself. But what attracted him to that particular DAW, and were any hardware synths used alongside digital plugins?
I mean, in high school and stuff, I was in GarageBand, and it was the easiest transition from that. I know Pro Tools well enough to be able to like take live sessions and pull the audio out of there and edit it a little bit, but I just love working in Logic and kind of keeping everything streamlined through that. Yeah, it's really a lot of the typical plugins, like SoundToys. I really like UAD plugins as well. Fab filter stuff, But most of my, like effects-wise, everything I'm using is, like, just kind of have these, like, two pedal boards set up, but I have nothing, like, kind of Velcroed down or whatever, so I can just... My template really becomes my outboard effects at that point. So when I start a new project, I, like, change all the pedals around to kind of create a new sound, so I'm not, like, working with the same stuff all the time. I used a Moog subfatty for a lot of the leads and all the bass. And I think almost, I mean, close to every single track in the game has the subfatty as the bass, just like underneath there to like show some support. But I did use like some contact synths, and I used like this old like NES emulated synth. And I also used like I love the main Logic Retro synth for some reason, for pads. And it's cool to like, then you can manipulate that a little bit with plugins and stuff too.
When it comes to composing for video games, there's often a lot more to it than simply using a DAW to mix together separate parts and recordings. At first, musicians had to learn code to write for the earliest chips, before trackers came along, popularized by systems like the Amiga. Today, a lot of VGM is crafted in a digital audio workstation, before then filtering through middleware as players move around the game world. Middleware, such as WYs, allows for a range of different dynamic effects, which has made soundtracks increasingly interactive and responsive. But they're not the only way of implementing reactive systems. So how does Outer Wilds handle its audio during gameplay?
We actually didn't use any middleware. It was all coded in. I just sent it over to the implementer and told him my ideas. And a lot of it was just simple fades and stuff. Since it just, when there's not music playing, it goes into the sound effects. Like it goes into the other sound designer, like all of his like explosions and things like that. That kind of takes over, and it was also nice, like, because then I was able to give him space to create like the beautiful waterfalls and all that of Timber Hearth, and like the really dangerous elements that you come across, especially when you get like sucked up into a tornado and all that. So he was able to let his sound design breathe, and then when my sound design kicks in, or the music kicks in, like, it gave my music and textures a chance to breathe. And I feel like that's what really crafted the world into like kind of this dreamlike quality. When the other sound designer and I were able to kind of, his sound effects would either be breathing while my music was out, and then my music was able to breathe, and my Nomai textures were able to breathe while his sound design kind of got a little bit more minimal.
It's always insightful to hear the processes and technology that go into effective VGM. But they'd be nothing without an actual composer taking the reins. It's Andrew's inspiration that truly fuels the music of Outer Wilds, which still hides a lot more depth than we've been able to cover in this podcast. As we reach this episode's final minutes, though, there are a few key pieces left to discuss. However, when talking about tracks used toward the conclusion of the game, Andrew and I inevitably touched on several spoilers. From here, Much of our conversation is concerned with certain revelations about the plot, and how they affect the music. For example, Outer Wilds' central time loop, and how to stop it, is one of the driving mysteries of the narrative. As each loop comes to a close, before repeating again, it's accompanied by end times, a piece specifically written to signal an impending reset. There's even an alternate version, Final Voyage, which is saved for your very last loop before completing the game. Since the two are so closely tied, what's some of the background behind End Times, and how did he develop on the initial idea for Final Voyage?
That was really, really fun to work on, honestly, because the End Times theme that kicks in at the end of every loop, I wrote, that was one of the first, because even in the build we did for GDC, like a couple years ago, and then like the build before that, we did have the End Times theme in there, and intact, it really is super, super similar to the I think I might have re-recorded some of the guitars and synths I used on there a little bit, but it is ultimately this version that I wrote like 5 or 6 years ago. And for the final End Times, I got to go back and add like the extra leads on there, and like it was cool to record a lot of the stuff with the banjo and with this End Times theme. I was basically recording with myself from my past, because there were all these guitar tones that I created when I was just kind of my setup 7 years ago was a lot more simple than it is now. So it was cool to like go back and have all this new knowledge that I've learned just after working on all these other projects and after working with so many talented people over 7 years, and having the ability to put that into a lot of the finality of the game. So I got to craft this just even bigger version of the End Times theme.
As Outer Wilds draws to a close, the player is led through an ending that absolutely rewards their curiosity and determination. The final scene evokes grand themes of connectivity and harmony, bringing all of the travellers and their individual instruments back together for one last performance. As you bring them one by one around, appropriately, the rich glow of a campfire, their tune builds up its full arrangement, complete with Esker's whistling. It's a satisfying and profound conclusion to one of gaming's most unique experiences, leaving just enough room for interpretation without needless obscurity.
That was like an idea I kind of had just coming from old Zelda games. It was really influenced by that. I just had this idea that it could be cool to have because he mentioned the traveler instruments, and I was like, what if all the travelers, instead of just having them play their own tunes, to have them all be playing part of the same song, kind of saying like, oh, we're all connected in this universe. And then I didn't even know what the an ending sequence would be, and then when Alex told me about how he was gonna have them all like kind of in the same area for like one final time, like I don't know, to me that was just like so touching, and I'm really glad how the ending turned out. I feel like it makes the game very poignant and beautiful, and talks about like human connection and like what like a lot of these existentialist ideas.
With the narrative fully explored, and the gameplay put to bed, there's little left but the all-important end credits. Credits are often a bittersweet time for gamers, who usually feel a mix of great achievement and loss. Composers seem to have a clear understanding of this, and credits music has always played an important role in VGM OSTs. You can even trace the philosophy back to classic high score tunes written for the earliest chips. Outer Wilds, which is drenched in detail and mystery, wouldn't miss such an opportunity to expand even further on their story through music. So 14.3 billion years, which accompanies the end credits, introduces cello to the palette, otherwise only heard in a short post-credits scene. Performed by David Tangney, the cello is very deliberately held back until the end. So what does it mean to the soundtrack as a whole?
The cello represents, this is a big spoiler, but it represents like the start of the new universe at the very end of the game. So basically the game and the soundtrack both end on that mourning theme that you hear at Timber Hearth, and then the cello plays it at the beginning of the new universe, and then it goes into the end credits. The string player that I worked with, David, did all the strings on that. Like, I just layered him. And he was brought in for that, and really, yeah, I really wanted to have this stripped back sound in the beginning of it, where it's just piano, just acoustic guitar, and then I have like that subtle guitar ambience in the background, and then like the cello kicks in, and still it's kind of like symbolizing the new universe, but using the old theme from the beginning of the game. And there's a part, like, then it goes into, like, the Nomai theme with all the strings, and it goes into, then I have it, like, kind of cut and go into, like, the very final time playing the original theme, like, but this time on acoustic guitar, and then that's, after that is when it kicks into the main theme, but with the whole string orchestra. But, yeah, that's, I did pull back on the synths a lot on the end credits, and I just wanted to make it feel like a more organic and orchestral version of the themes that people had been, like, that all players had been listening to the whole game. But with David, it was really easy. I mean, and we just set him up and got him a music stand, and I had, like, everything written out for him, and then we just kind of kept tracking him over and over again to, like, fill out the sound and make him sound like a huge string section. I'm used to doing all these smaller ensemble type things, especially from like indie films and stuff, and then this, with trailers too, like we'll overdub a soloist a lot. And then when I was at Nickelodeon, we used soloists and like string section, like smaller string sections, like the whole time on like every episode. So I was pretty used to it, and it was kind of cool to like go back and like get into that workflow of bringing in other people to record, rather than just, like, recording myself.
As you've heard, Outer Wilds is filled with thematic, thought-provoking, and beautiful music throughout, right up to its end credits. Across 7 years of development, Andrew Prahlo was able to really nail the project's atmosphere, which resulted in a soundtrack that's as compelling on its own as it is in-game. The title as a whole has received enormous praise since its full release in 2019 too. It's an experience that sticks with you, surprises you, and immerses you in an ambitious sci-fi story that doesn't rely on lazy, tired tropes. For players, it's a breath of fresh air in a sea of formulaic sludge, brave enough to take its own approach and at its own pace. For Andrew, the game proved an excellent way of sharing his music with a larger audience, despite years of impressive work in trailers and television. How does it feel to get such a widespread positive response, especially after the years of toil and love that went into Outer Wilds?
It was cool to know that people were really, really excited about the banjo music from the beginning. And when we would be, like when I was on the showroom floor for way back in the day when we were talking about it, like I would get a lot of comments on, oh, I really love the music. But to all of us, we had been working on it for so long, we didn't really know how like receptive everyone would be of it. We were really proud of the game, and I was extremely proud of the work I did in the musics that I wrote, but I had no idea that it would hit. Like, I mean, it's at like over 500,000 collective streams on Spotify right now, which is just absolutely insane to me. And I have people like sending me emails and asking questions, and it's been like really wonderful. And I'm honestly just honored that people have been so receptive to the music. It's not something that's really happened to me before, and to know that all this work that everyone put in was like, it was like an ultimate payoff of people being like, yeah, this is so cool, and it just makes me like incredibly happy, like, and just so grateful that I connected with people on a certain level with this music. I had no idea it would happen. I was just writing things that I thought sounded beautiful and made me feel nostalgic, so it really means, like, it just like warms my heart knowing that people are listening to it. And I've never had people like listen to my music this much, in the sense that it's connecting with people in a different way. Because when you write trailer music, of course a lot of people see that trailer and stuff, but really you're writing for that huge project, and you're a little piece of something that's grander than you. And in this, I got to really focus on the music on my own and write so much music. And the fact that this has been like a 7-year, this was like a huge chapter of my life. 7 years, like, is a long time. And to be working on the same kind of music. So it's, after a while, like, I kind of was able to like take a step back and be like, wow, this has really been something I've been working for really my whole career, to have people listen to my music. And connect with it in the way that I connected with it, and see it in a lot of ways through the same light I did when I was writing it. Or maybe it's cool to hear other people's, the way that they respond to the music, and their ideas behind it and the questions they have about that. I mean, yeah, it's been really surreal and incredible. And yeah, it's the first time this has happened. So I'm just super, super, super happy. Like, I can't say that more than enough.
Thanks to Andrew for speaking to me for the sound test. But thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you may be listening on. There are still many episodes to come in this second series, with its opening 8 and the first season freely available through just about every popular podcast provider. On my next documentary podcast, I'll delve into the trio of soundtracks that come with Detroit Become Human, each handled by a different composer. Although unable to schedule an interview with John Paisano, I was very lucky to record expansive conversations with the game's other two musicians, Philip Shepherd and Nima Fakhara. If you'd like to hear that podcast early, ahead of public release, head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave. There, you can pledge your support for as little as a single pound or dollar to unlock early access to podcasts, unedited interviews, full quality WAV files, a full backlog of otherwise unavailable live shows, and more. Either way, I hope you enjoyed this edition of ST2, and don't forget to join me every Friday, 7 p.m. GMT, for a live and interactive show of VGM Celebration.